And now, News Talk 1360 WCHL presents Art of Potential, an illuminating talk show about getting educated, getting hired, and getting inspired. Hosted by the staggeringly positive Kristen Heemstra, an experienced human resources manager and college admissions consultant. And now, here's Kristen on WCHL.
Hi, this is Kristen Heemstra. Welcome to the Art of Potential show. We are going to be talking about one of my favorite topics today, which is leadership. And we have an expert here, Erica Anderson. Erica is founder of the consulting firm Proteus. And Erica, your firm specializes in developing leaders for the future, correct?
Yes. The way we talk about it is that we focus on leader readiness. So giving people the skills, the mindset, the understanding they need to meet their future, to create the future that they want.
So one of the ways that I got in touch with Erica and decided that she'd be a great person to interview is because I'm a firm believer that an organization's culture is just so important to the organization's success. And Erica, you recently did a piece in Forbes. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Yes. The piece was called the most important reason people fail at a new job. And it was kind of leveraged off a piece of information that I had gotten that didn't surprise me, but I thought it was important to share with people that there's some research that shows that 89% of the time when people fail in a new job, it's a result of poor cultural fit. And totally aligns with my experience working with organizations over the last 25 years and really lines up with the reason that we, my company, Proteus, and I got into working with culture in the first place, which is that part of our practice is around vision and strategy. I have a book called Being Strategic, and we help organizations get clear about where are you starting from, what future do you want to create, what's your vision for the future, and then how are you going to get there. And what we found is that often a senior team would get very clear on the future they wanted to create, but then they would realize that the culture of the organization was not going to sustain them moving toward that future. And so then they had to figure out how to shift the culture. And we started, this was about 10 years ago, we started doing work on what is culture, what is organizational culture, and how do you shift it? So that's become a part of our practice.
Oh my gosh. And I mean, that's like, in a lot of ways, addressing the pink elephant in the room.
Absolutely.
To get it to move.
Absolutely. And so we were helped dramatically in this by my business partner, Jeff Mitchell. His brother is an important person in a field called social marketing, which is basically, and this is said very simply, but it's basically how do you get people, how do you create mass behavior change? Mm-hmm. How do you market a new behavior to people? Like getting people to wear their seat belts or encouraging teenagers not to smoke, you know, important shifts like that. And what they found over the years, we sort of boiled down some of their key findings and we use them in our organizational culture work. And one of the things that they found is that people, well, two important streams of understanding. People will behave differently. People will do new behaviors if they believe that those behaviors are easy, rewarding, and normal. And those are our words. They use much more complicated words, but we've kind of boiled it down. And easy means I know how to do it, and there aren't any impediments organizationally to me doing it. Because lots of times there are it's hard to do certain behaviors in an organization. There are just things in the way. It's literally hard to do them. You have to get 15 layers of approval or stuff like that. The second thing, rewarding, means it gives me something I value, and I'll come back to that in a minute. It's personally rewarding for me to do this.
Okay.
And the third thing, which I find very interesting, normal, means people I admire and emulate do this thing, and people who I think are like me do it. That's what normal consists of. Other people that I look around and I say, you're like me. Oh, you're doing this? Okay, then I guess it's okay for me to do it. And also people in a way that I aspire to be. So this is really
important. I'm sorry, this sounds a lot like peer pressure, but keep going.
Well, but it's not. It is in a way, because one of the ways we determine whether or not something is okay to do is we look around and we say, do people who I consider my peers, do they do this? It's one, like, for instance, there's a really interesting piece of information that shows if you want to lose weight, for instance, you should hang out with people who are the weight you want to be. Right? If you hang out with people who are overweight, then that's the normal. That's what's normal.
Right.
So, I said when we were talking about rewarding, I said it's important to give people things they value. So this is the key to what we've understood about organizational culture is that The way we define corporate culture is that it consists of accepted behaviors and the beliefs and values that underlie and promote those behaviors. And to kind of take that apart, this is what that means. So people value certain things. It means exactly that. They find them valuable. These things are important to them. And usually as a result of their values, then they believe things, and then they behave in certain ways because of their beliefs. So I'll give you an example. So let's say that you had somebody who really valued, in a company, who really valued serving customers. Mm-hmm. That was really important to them. Yep. They felt like, you know, I'm here, that, you know, I want to serve customers. That's valuable to me. I would find that rewarding. Now, people can have conflicting beliefs rising out of the same value. So one person who values serving customers might believe that in order to truly serve customers, you should never disagree with them, no matter what. The customer is always right. Somebody else might believe that, wow, if I really value serving customers, if they're going down a bad path, if they're asking for something that is impossible, or I should tell them, I should be honest with them. So as you can see, those two different beliefs would result in two different behaviors.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay, so let's say that you wanted to change the culture in this organization, and let's say it's the organization where the people never disagree with customers, no matter what. And unfortunately, if that happens, if you really institute like the customer's never wrong, then people will say yes to a customer when they can't deliver on that yes. They won't tell them when something's not possible, right?
Which leaves the customer in a lurch.
Exactly. So you're one thing that's important to know when you're trying to change organizational culture is it is virtually impossible to change people's values. So you have to get down to what their values are. So let's say you have a company which is largely about customer service. Let's say it's an online company where there's a lot of telephone, interaction. It's like Zappos. You want to be all about service, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you have people who don't value serving customers, you're not going to be able to create the culture you want. You're just not. You have to hire for that because values are like, the ground. They're foundational. It's very difficult to change them. But as long as you got people who valued customer service, who that was personally important to them, you could shift their behaviors as long as you shifted their beliefs. So if they were never disagreeing with customers, if you helped them understand that, you know what, there are certain situations where we should disagree with customers because, see, that will serve them better in the long run.
Mm-hmm.
And you can explain it to them in a way that makes it easy, makes them still feel like it's going to be rewarding, it's still going to feed that value of customer service, and it feels normal. Other people around them are doing it, people they admire and think are good people are doing it, then they'll shift. So you kind of have to change culture behavior by behavior, so you have to get very specific about the behaviors you want to change. But boy, you really, really have to key into the values because as I said, virtually impossible to change people's values.
Well, and I'm finding it interesting that you can change beliefs easier than you can change values.
Yeah. Well, because beliefs arise out of values.
Right, right. It just, I don't know why, but for some reason it's always seemed to me that changing someone's beliefs, or I guess I'm thinking of belief systems, but anyway. No, that makes sense, now that you say that.
Yeah, and it's really interesting work. What we found is that a lot of people who try to change culture, they try and do it on a kind of very superficial sloganeering kind of level.
Yep, that's what I've seen.
It just doesn't work.
Yeah.
It just doesn't work. I mean, it's not that it's bad. It's just ineffective.
No, because people don't buy into it.
Exactly.
Right.
So unless you're in touch with, okay, so what do we want people to do? Like we did, can I give another example?
Or absolutely.
Okay. So a number of years ago, we were working with a company. And we did this vision strategy work with them, and they realized that they wanted to be much more kind of entrepreneurial and risk-taking as a company, and that their current culture just was not going to support that. They were a culture largely of scientists, and they'd come to be a media company, and most of the people were still scientists, and they were cautious and rigorous and all those kinds of behaviors, right?
Oh, yeah.
So the good thing was that they were very competitive. They had a value around winning. And their belief was that the way they would win is be correct in their data. They were thinking like scientists, right?
Right.
And so they shifted the belief to the way we're going to win in this new environment is beat our competitors. And one of the ways we have to beat our competitors is get earlier to market than them. So that shifted, and they got that. I mean, they're really smart people, and the management really supported it. So then they started helping them do some of those behaviors, which are, you know, take some risks, try an idea without betting it 150 times, you know, mm-hmm. be willing to fail, those kinds of things. And it really shifted.
Oh, that is terrific.
Yeah.
Well, I want to hear much more about this. We do need to take a break. This is Kristen Heemstra. I am talking with Eric Anderson, and you are listening to the Art of Potential Show.
You're listening to Art of Potential on WCHL. Once again, here's your host, Kristen Heemstra.
Welcome back. This is Kristen Heemstra, and I am talking with Erica Anderson. We're talking about culture right now. So you were just telling us the example of the scientists and, you know, shifting their beliefs while maintaining their values is one way that an organization changed the culture of an organization, correct? Mm-hmm. Did I follow that?
Yes, absolutely. Very clear.
So my question is, if 89% of the reason that people fail at the job is culturally driven, what does that say about the hiring practice? It almost sounds like that's where you would need to start implementing.
That is the perfect question, because what happens, and this was, I try to, you know, point this out, and other people have talked about this a lot, is that generally speaking, people hire based on experience.
Yep.
And resume and mm-hmm. kind of personal liking. Like
yep.
if you look at someone's resume and go, yep, that's it all lines up, and I see they have the experience and skills I need, and then you have an interview with them and they seem like a nice person, just kind of generically nice person, they'll probably get hired.
Mm-hmm.
And what we try and help happen is to include culture in the conversation. So one of the things we do with our clients is we try to help them get clear about values and competencies. So, and I don't mean competencies like job competencies. What I
right.
mean, and I wrote another book called Growing Great Employees, and I explain this, that there's a concept called core competencies that's become much more common over the last decade. And what we use it to mean is not, you know, what are the skills for your job? It's what personal characteristics are you looking for in every person in your organization? Because that's one of the frames of culture, right?
Right. Okay.
So, like, for instance, an example I give in my book is let's say that there are two companies. There's a company that invents kids' toys, and there's a company that creates life-saving medical devices.
Okay.
So if you're trying to create the core competencies for the life-saving medical device company, you probably want people who are rigorous and independent and organized and, you know, all those kinds of things, right? Life-saving medical device.
Right, yes, right.
if you have the kids' toy company, you want people who are creative and probably gregarious and collaborative and, you know, willing to take risks and have fun as an important, you know, their fun. So those are two very different sets of core competencies. And if you define them, what we found is that if a company can really do this, can really define a handful of 4 to 6 core competencies and then even put, you know, kind of behavioral indicators under them, here's what we mean by this, and then use that in the hiring process, then they're much more likely to hire people who are a good fit for the culture. So that the finance person who would be great at the kids' toy company doesn't get hired for the medical life-saving device company.
Okay, I hear that. But then in the back of my mind, I'm going, I don't know that I want a really creative accountant. I mean, I just don't know that that's who I would want doing the numbers for
it's a great concern. So by creative, I don't mean they're creative with the numbers.
Right.
I mean that their personality is creative. So that
right.
I'll give a good example of exactly what I mean. In fact, a lot of our clients are media clients. We do mm-hmm. a lot of work in television, a lot of programmers and cable operators and stuff. And especially on the programming side, they're very creative people. And I have actually seen people in the finance and IT and legal parts just get blown out for exactly this reason, for a bad cultural fit. If you, like, for instance, a client of ours, they just hired a CFO who's a perfect cultural fit. It's a very It's a highly creative company. They're very nonlinear. They're always looking for the next big thing. And he can roll with that.
Yep.
Right? Mm-hmm. So I can imagine, and they had a previous person who didn't do well who was like, wait a minute, stop. Right. Now, you have to explain this to me 15 different ways. And they're like, oh my God, dude, get out of here. You know. So he can be okay with that. He can bring his financial acumen into those creative mm-hmm. discussions and not feel like a fish out of water.
Okay, so it's really just the entire culture. It's not even departmental cultures. Because, I mean, and you know this from working with organizations too, different departments will have their very own life and their very own way of being. And, you know, that's kind of...
You know, and I think that happens in the absence of an overall culture. Because people, we're tribal creatures, you know. Mm-hmm. And if the big tribe doesn't have a culture... Then
we'll
the little tribes will make up their own.
Right?
Right?
Which is not always a good thing, I might add.
But generally not a good thing, because then you get down into like, it's like, you know, Italy, when it was a bunch of little teeny fiefdoms, it wasn't really a country. Then it's like, oh, I hate dealing with those people in marketing because they got a whole different culture than us people down in IT, you know?
Oh, absolutely. So as the culture, as you hire or bring in, how does this cultural piece fit under the big umbrella, which is leadership? And I realize that's a loaded question, and you've written a book on this.
I can kind of take it apart. So culture, like everything else, has to happen, even though there are many things that can and should happen from the bottom up, and certainly part of good leadership is generosity, you know, with power and with authority and with time and with belief, but one of the things that has to resonate from the top outwards is culture.
Yes.
So a good leader has to be clear about how important it is to create a culture and to create the kind of culture that he or she wants to create, that he or she thinks mm-hmm. will establish the sort of company that can create the future that they want.
And one of the things I just like to piggyback on, it's not just out in public that this culture is created. One of the things I've seen just over the years is that the private moments have to also show that core culture, because it there's integrity in it then.
Yes, it would be impossible for me to agree with you more.
Right.
So just to sort of segue over to the, you know, we can talk more about leadership, but one of the leadership model that we use that's in this new book, Leading So People Will Follow, it focuses on six core timeless attributes that we've seen that people look for in leaders before they will fully sign up, before they'll fully accept that person as their leader. And one of them is passion. And by passion, we don't mean loudness, we mean depth of commitment.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the reason I'm saying this is because it's right to what you're pointing out, that if a leader is superficial in their commitment or commits inauthentically or kind of drifts away when things get tough, people just back way off. They're like, I don't believe this. This is not true.
They don't trust him.
This is just, you know, cynical.
No, absolutely. And even I was thinking also just in terms of the way they treat people. So if you have someone who's out there kind of great with the people in large settings and really gregarious and really happy, and then behind the doors they're spending their time kind of belittling the staff, you're going to see the same type of trickle effect out into the entire organization, because it does reflect a lack of a core connection to what their message is.
Yes, 100%. People are very, you know, and I can talk more about this, but what people really looking for good leaders, it's wired into us. I mean, if you think about it, until a couple hundred years ago, the person you chose to be your leader, that was really a life and death decision.
Mm-hmm. That makes
right?
sense.
If you chose badly, you're going to starve to death in the winter or get overrun by the invading Mongols or whatever, right? So, and even though now, you know, I mean, maybe it's not a life and death situation, that wiring doesn't change in a few hundred years. So when someone feels dangerous to us in a way as a leader, like they could lead us into death, you know, we just don't sign up. And it's not like we will quit immediately.
No.
But for instance, one of the things I started noticing when I developed this model starting about 15 years ago is that you go into situations and sometimes there's the person who's the appointed leader. They're mm-hmm. the CEO or they're the GM or whatever. but they're not the accepted leader. They're not the person that people look to. Like, they'll get up and start talking, and other people will be kind of glancing at the CFO or the CIO to see what that person thinks, right?
Right, because they trust that person.
Exactly. And so over the years, this was very fascinating to me, and I started to connect it to, at the same time, my kids were young, and I was reading them fairy stories and folktales, and I believe strongly that stories for most of humanity's history are the carriers of wisdom and knowledge. Mm-hmm. You know, until a couple hundred years ago, most people couldn't read, and the way you learned kind of how to be a human being and how to succeed in society was through story. And so I started to notice that a lot of these stories I was reading, and this will be no surprise to you, everybody knows these stories, there's some big task to be done. You know, the princess has to be rescued. And there's three brothers, and the older two try and fail spectacularly. And the youngest brother, who nobody believes in at the beginning and is sitting in the rags by the fire, you know, ends up doing it, ends up rescuing the princess, becoming the king. We all live happily ever after. And I noticed that these stories exist all over the world, and that always in these stories, the kid has to demonstrate or develop and then demonstrate a handful of characteristics in order to succeed.
Well, let's take a break because I want to know what these characteristics are. Okay? So you are listening to the Art of Potential show. We're going to take a quick break, and we're going to come right back with Erica Anderson.
You're listening to Art of Potential on WCHL. Once again, here's your host, Kristen Heemstra.
Welcome back. This is Kristen Heemstra. You are listening to the Art of Potential show, and I'm having a fascinating interview with Erica Anderson, and we are about to learn what the characteristics are of the young brother who's going to save the princess.
Okay, so think of this, even though, you know, these are traditional stories and it's always a boy, think of it as just a metaphor, right? It could be a girl, it could be black, white, old, young, but it's the leader, it's the accepted leader, the person who gets to be the king and we're all going to live happily ever after. So here's what I saw over and over again, and I'll just say them and then I'll explain them a little bit. So the accepted leader is farsighted, passionate, courageous, wise, generous, and trustworthy. And farsighted means that he or she can see, can articulate a compelling and inclusive vision of a possible future. Like that kid, the very beginning, he's just some little kid, right? And he's saying, I am going to get to the top of that glass mountain and rescue the princess. And he says it so with such faith and so compellingly that people come along. You know, people sign up along the journey to help him out.
Because he believes it.
Exactly. 100% he believes it, and he can see it so clearly. So that's farsighted. Then passionate, as we said before, means depth of commitment. Mm-hmm. That kid is not going to get swayed from his purpose. And all in these fairy tales, all kinds of bad things always get to happen involving, you know, snakes and burning oil and stuff. And he just keeps going. He really does not turn aside from his commitment to his quest. He's passionate. And courageous means both, you know, what we think of as courage, that tough decisions, limited information, but it also means, and this is interesting, this always comes up in these stories, it also means doing things that are personally difficult for you for the good of the enterprise or the good of the quest. It's sort of like Indiana Jones and the snakes, right? Did it have to be snakes? You know, it's that thing that is toughest for you, because when people see that the leader is willing to compromise his or her own personal comfort for the good of the enterprise, that speaks volumes about, they really are courageous for us, right?
Right. They're doing something for us. Okay.
Yes. Wise means that you really listen, you're really objective, you learn from your experience, and you change and grow, and you share that learning with your followers. You make the right choices. You make the moral choices. In these stories, there's often a situation where the kid gets given some good advice by the resident, you know, shaman, and doesn't take it, and bad things ensue, but then he gets the chance to do it again, and he does it right. He's wise. He learns from his experience. And generosity is generosity on all levels. Generosity, you know, assuming positive intent, sharing resources and power and authority. In these stories, there is almost invariably a little vignette toward the very beginning where there's, you know, an old lady by the side of the road, and she comes begging for a coin or bread or whatever, and the older two brothers just blow her off and, you know, get turned into toads or whatever. And then the younger brother...
A lot of stories going on here, yeah, okay.
Yeah, and then the younger brother says, yes, of course, even though he has less. He has his simple bread and he breaks it. And she turns into a wizard and helps him, you know, it's right. All good. So there's a strong communication that the leader, a true leader, is generous. Whatever resources there are, he or she shares them out equitably. And then the last one is trustworthy, and that's really the bottom line. You know, this kid, you know, you can take his word to the bank that if he says he's going to marry the princess,
he's going to,
you know, she can send out the invitation. He's actually going to get it done, right? And now, you know, I've told it in the story form, but I really, if you think about it, those are the things that we look for almost unconsciously. When I say these things out loud to people, I've never had anyone go, what? No, I don't care if my leaders are generous or passionate, you know. People always go, yes, that is the best. You know, it's funny because when I share this model, when we share this model with people, I think the almost the first place most people go is they think about the best leader they've ever known.
Okay.
And they go, farsighted, passionate, courageous, wise, generous, straight. Yeah, he or she was all those things. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then they think about the worst leader they've ever known. Oh. They go, nope, maybe, nope, you know?
Mm-hmm. Right, because you can have, you know, farsightedness, but without some of the other attributes to contribute
yes,
to it.
Yes, and in fact, we're not unrealistic. And what I've seen over the years is if somebody demonstrates four or five of these qualities in pretty good doses and is seen to be working on the other ones, we'll go, okay, I'm here, I'm with you, you know? Mm-hmm. But if they only have two or three, even if they really have them, it still feels dangerous. Like I've known a lot of leaders who were, for instance, farsighted and passionate, but who didn't balance that with wisdom and generosity. And then it's like, still doesn't feel like it's going to work for me. You know?
Well, I don't know. I would be afraid of some ethical combinations there.
Say that again, sorry.
I would be afraid of some ethical breaches or combinations there. If you have someone who's farsighted and passionate, the courage and wisdom seems to have a side of ethics to it. Or, you know, I'm almost hearing some of this as like the golden rule kind of thing. Treat others like you would like to be treated. And, you know, wisdom, generosity, trustworthiness, those for sure are all things that we would hope that, you know, we would have and that would be part of that golden rule thing, but the
yes, you're exactly right, and you've stumbled on something which we've found to be true, which is that there's sort of two halves of this model. Like if there's a wonderful book, I don't know if you're familiar with it, called Good to Great. It's a long time bestseller and business book, and in that book, the author Jim Collins talks about what he called level five leadership, and he was really surprised to find that the leaders of these great companies that he profiled in his book combined two almost oxymoronic kind of thing. He said that they combined fierce professional will with deep personal humility. And when I read that book, I thought, that's right. That's our model. So, you know, farsighted, passionate, courageous, fierce professional will, wise, generous, trustworthy, deep personal humility.
Mm-hmm. No, it does. And those all then combined. So culture is created from the top down, correct?
Yes, absolutely. Now, it has to be you have to, there's also a bottom-up element because, as I said, if you have people who do not, at the heart of it, value the things that are important to your success, and I'll give you an example of that. We, in the early, I guess mid-90s, mid to late 90s, yeah, in early 2000s, we were working with Blockbuster at the time, had not yet been eclipsed by Netflix.
Right.
And they really wanted to improve their customer service in their stores, and we were trying to help them. And what we discovered is that the people who they were hiring at the entry level in the stores didn't really value customer service. The reason they wanted to work at Blockbuster is because they liked movies.
They did. I know, because I know
right?
quite a few people who worked there, yes.
Yeah, and they thought it was pretty sexy to be surrounded by all these movies all the time and to know a lot about movies and to talk with their friends about movies. So they realized, folks at Blockbuster realized that if they were really going to change their culture, they were going to have to do a kind of wholesale firing and hiring. And that was just too big of a pill for them to swallow, and they were not able to change that culture.
No, but it also, to the point of the top down, I mean, the reason that Netflix kind of took over was because they did value that their customers and getting movies to them in the easiest possible way.
Yes, and that goes to they to me, I've met the head of the head marketing guy at Netflix. He's a great guy. I think he and his business partner, they are most of these things. They're farsighted. They're passionate. They've shown themselves to be pretty courageous, like when they did that kind of dumb thing recently where they tried to split the two in half and everybody just screamed and yelled and their stock price went way down. They came and said, "We're sorry. That was wrong. We're going to put it back together." And that was courageous, you know?
No, it is. And I would also, to your point, you did say this earlier, but I do think courage is the ability to say, "Oops, I made a mistake," and "Oops, I was wrong."
Yeah. In fact, boy, we're really lined up, Kristen. In fact, one of the things in this new book, and maybe so people will follow, that I've done is, over the years, we realized that we needed to really behavioralize these six attributes if we wanted to help people be able to learn them.
Yes, that makes
sense. So for each of the six, there are five clear, simple behavioral indicators. And one of the ones under courage is admits mistakes and apologizes. And to me, that's one of the, a good apology. Oh my gosh, it's so disarming, and it really takes courage to be able to say, "I'm sorry, I did such and such, and here's what I intend to do to fix it." That is a really courageous act.
It is, and it's an act of ownership. And
that's the behavioral indicator right before it. That's the fifth one. The fourth one is takes full responsibility for his or her action.
It does. It speaks volumes. This is the Art of Potential Show with Kristen Heemstra, and I have been talking with Erica Anderson. Erica, can you tell us where to reach you? How do people get in touch with you or learn more about you?
Oh, I would love to. So there are two easy ways online. We have a website, Proteus, Proteus-international.com is my business website. And then you can also go to ericaanderson.com. And Erica is spelled E-R-I-K-A, and Anderson is spelled A-N-D-E-R-S-E-N, ericaanderson.com.
Wonderful. Thank you very much.
You're listening to Art of Potential on WCHL. Once again, here's your host, Kristen Heemstra.
So welcome back. This is Kristen Heemstra talking with Erica Anderson. Fascinating conversation about leadership. So I want to talk more about these actual behaviors that you just mentioned in the last segment. So you've got all of these six attributes that you mentioned. And then did you say that you broke them all down into measurable behaviors that are correlated?
Exactly. So there are five behavioral indicators for each of the attributes. And in the book, the way I've written the book is there's a chapter on each of the attributes, and I had the privilege to use, I've coached and worked with a lot of very senior people over the years, and for each of the attributes, I picked two people, actual leaders, senior leaders, and fairly big companies that I've worked with for a long time, who I offer as exemplars of that attribute and use stories of them, actual stories of them leading. And then I break it down into the five indicators and then have help for you. You know, if you're reading and you think to yourself, boy, I really need to get better at farsighted, and particularly I need to get better at the part that's articulating my vision in a compelling and inclusive way, then there's a little part of the chapter that has some activities, some ideas. Here's how you can get better at this.
Okay, so let's go through these. So if you're farsighted, you need to be able to articulate your vision in a compelling and inclusive way.
And the other four are, so it goes in this order, sees possible futures that are good for the enterprise, articulates their vision in a compelling and inclusive way, model the vision, which means you act according to it every day, which is, you know, something you said earlier. Fourth one is sees past obstacles, knows that they exist, doesn't pretend they don't, but sees past them. And then the fifth and very important one is invites others to participate in the vision. Truly farsighted people, they don't just say, "I'm going up the hill." They say, "Let's go up the hill. How are we going to go up the hill together?"
And people who decide have already made the decision they want to go up the hill with this leader.
Because of the way they're articulating it and modeling it and all that, then people say, "Yes, I'm with you. Let's go.
You're my hero. Let's go."
Yeah, exactly. I want to go on your quest. Let's go together.
Well, it's funny because a lot of these things. Are you familiar with the work of Joseph Campbell?
Oh, absolutely. And I bow to him in the first chapter of the book. In his Hero of a Thousand Faces, the difference is he focused on, you know, mythology. He focused on godlike heroes and what we look like, what we look for in our godlike heroes. And I'm focusing closer to the day-to-day. I looked at fairy tales and folk tales and How is that a map to the people we will accept to be our leaders on a day-to-day basis?
Which I completely see the parallels in that. And in some ways, the leadership journey is everybody's journey. It's you becoming kind of a greater
100%.
Leader.
100%. I just did a speech about this the other day, and there were about 200 people, and I said, okay, let me do a little informal data collection before I start. It was HR people. And I said, how many of you are responsible, at least in part, for leader development or leader effectiveness at your organization? Most of them raised their hand. And then I said, how many of you consider yourselves leaders? And I knew they weren't all really senior people. You know, they were all, every one of them raised their hand.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I think that more and more, as society kind of flattens out and gets less hierarchical, and we realize we can all be
have to
experts,
be.
We can all excel, we can all lead in our little tribes and cues, you know, I think everybody wants to know, or not everybody perhaps, but most people want to know, how can I lead? How can I even lead in my family or in my, you know, in my PTA group or in my, you know.
Right, because it does play out in all aspects of your
exactly.
life. Exactly. It does. So then we have passion. So what are your five for passion?
Passionate, it's commit honestly, meaning make commitments based on what you authentically believe. Make a clear case without being dogmatic.
Oh, that's interesting.
That's okay. Good, right?
Yeah. And how do you know when you're being dogmatic? Because that's...
Well, it's in the book I define dogmatic, and in dictionary definition of the word dogmatic is to state as fact something that's an opinion. This is what's true versus this is what I believe, right?
Okay. Well done, yep.
Yeah, so then the third one is invite real dialogue about their passion. Act in support of their passion, and that's the analog of model their vision. So if you say, I strongly believe, back to your earlier point, that our culture should be one of creativity and risk-taking, and you jump on people's heads when they take a risk, well, you know, hello?
Right.
And then the last one is remain committed despite adversity and setbacks.
Mm-hmm. That, you know, and that's also a good recipe, honestly, for a marriage or any relationship you get in, whether it's your career.
Absolutely.
Or, you know, it's...
And people, that's one that people really look for. That's a big indicator. If they see a leader who kind of drifts off, you know, it's like, who says something's important, and then if the going gets a little rough or it doesn't look like it's going to be politically expedient, they kind of, you know, that's not going to work.
No, it's not. And in other situations where I've seen that, you've seen leaders who are like, oh, yes, your input's important, or yes, we want to hear from you. And they'll say this to the staff. They'll say this in, you know, various forms. And then when they start getting and receiving the information that they've asked for, say, oh, no, I really didn't mean that. Or, you know, kind of diminishing it. You do see that. And then you see a lack of information flow from the bottom.
Well, absolutely. And that, you know, that some of that goes to courage, too. So the ones for courageous are make necessary, tough choices. That's just part of being a good leader. Sometimes you just have to pick.
Yep.
Right? So put themselves at risk for the good of the enterprise and then do things that are personally difficult. So those are two different things. They're related, but they're different. So in an organization, there are sometimes, like one of the guys that I pulled out as a courageous leader in my book, he's taken actions that he knew might actually lose him his job, but he really felt like this is for the good of the enterprise. I'm willing to put myself on the line for the enterprise. So there's that. But then there's also things that are personally difficult for you. Like this same guy is just a lovely, nice man, and sometimes he has to have really tough conversations with people. And I know it's for him like pulling his fingernails out by the roots, but he does it because it, you know, he needs to do it for the good of the enterprise.
Yeah.
Next one is take full responsibility for their actions, which you and I talked about earlier. And the last one is admit and apologize for mistakes, which I love and is such an act of courage.
Mm-hmm. It is. Okay, so then you have wisdom.
So
how do you qualify?
Why?
Yeah, this is going to be interesting.
These are great. So the first one is that wise leaders are deeply curious. They really listen. The next one is that they assess situations objectively. And that combination of curiosity and objectivity is the foundation of wisdom.
I get that. I totally
right?
get that, yes.
Then they reflect on and learn from their experience using their curiosity and their objectivity. They see patterns and share their insights with others, and they act based on what they believe to be morally right. People look to see, do you have a moral compass as a leader, and are you actually behaving according to it, right? And then generous is assume positive intent, which is a huge thing, and we talk about it all the time, you know, to assume that people, generally speaking, are trying to do the right thing, trying to do good work. When leaders assume that, it just lubricates the whole organization.
It really does. It really does. And it gives people, it makes people feel safe. And when they feel safe,
absolutely. It makes them open up. If you expect me to be good, then I am free to be good.
Yep.
You know? They share power and authority. They share what they know. They freely give credit, praise, and reward. And they provide the resources necessary for people to succeed.
Wow. And that, I'd just like to talk about that last one. One of the challenges I've seen as I work with job seekers who haven't successfully fit in with an organization is training. And just want to make a quick plug for that. If you are running an organization, making sure the people you hire are adequately trained would fall under this generosity piece.
Oh, I totally agree. I mean, that is a, when you say provide the resources necessary for others to succeed, people immediately go to money, but it's usually not money. It's usually skills, bandwidth, you know, room to maneuver.
Right.
It's that kind of stuff, right?
It is. And if they have the tools that they need, the classes they need, the knowledge they need, you know, and even the training just to do the job, because the jobs are so much more sophisticated now. So just because you can do X, Y, and Z on the computer doesn't mean you can do it to the specs of the company. Okay, teach them how.
Totally agree.
Yeah. So I don't know if you've seen that, but that's been a common theme.
Yep. And then the last one, trustworthy. Tell the truth as they understand it. Do what they say they will do. Keep confidences, speak and act for the greater good, and are capable and get results. And that's really the bottom line.
Yeah.
I mean, if you had the other five and didn't have trustworthy, people are still going to step back. Because,
they are.
You know, that is the bottom line for a leader. Are you going to do what you say you're going to do? And, or, you know, if you can't, tell us why, apologize, keep going, you know, maneuver. If you can't rely on the leader's word and that the leader keeps confidences and tells the truth and tells the same truth to everybody, you know.
I like that, the same truth to everybody.
That's what, you know, sometimes I'll coach leaders and they'll say, oh, yeah, I'm trustworthy. In fact, I was coaching this guy last month. Oh, I'm definitely trustworthy. I said, okay, so let me just push on that a little bit. So let's say somebody comes into your office with a great idea and you go, that's a great idea. We're going to pursue this. And then 10 minutes later, somebody else comes into your office with a great but mutually exclusive idea, and you say, that's a great idea. We're going to pursue it. What do you think is going to happen when those two people compare notes, right?
Mm-hmm.
You're not. And he said, oh, yeah, wow, I do that all the time.
Okay, well, there's a mirror for you. Well, Erica, it has been wonderful talking to you. And I wish you best of luck leading So People Will Follow. It will be available in October of 2012, and we will have a link on the Art of Potential website.
Thank you so much. You're a wonderful interviewer, and this has been a lot of fun.